Welcome to the Custom House, inspecting literary texts of all shapes and sizes from any point in origin to discover just what it is they are trying to import into our consciousness. We discuss literature as a thinking process, expanding interpretations of the written word, and exposing social frameworks in order to learn about ourselves and strengthen our community.
Welcome to the Custom House on WFHB. I'm your host, Doug Storm. Today we're going to speak with a photographer who mixes the word with the image to produce portraits that seem to me to stand as much as social and cultural commentary as they do art, and appear to turn the very subject of that portrait into commentary as well. We'll try to unpack and inspect that statement in the next half hour. Our guest today is Jeffrey Wolin, the Ruth N. Halls Professor of Photography at Indiana University. Wolin's recent books include a series of portraits of Holocaust survivors, Written in Memory, Portraits of the Holocaust, a series of portraits of Vietnam War veterans called Inconvenient Stories, as well as a series of portraits of recent immigrants to central Indiana called New Faces at the Crossroads. He's currently working on a series of portraits depicting Bloomington, Indiana residents from a section of the town called Pigeon Hill. He has had numerous exhibitions in museums, and much of his work lives in permanent collections of places like the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Art Institute of Chicago, and the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. Much of Wolin's work can be sampled on his website, jeffreywolin.com. Welcome to the Custom House, Jeff.
Oh, it's great to be here, Doug.
From the list of book titles, we can discover a couple of key facets. One is obvious to photography, that's portraits. The other seems maybe not to belong, the word. Is in there quite a bit. The Holocaust book is Written in Memory, and the veterans book is called Stories. Can you describe for the audience a little bit what that entails in your work?
You mean the combination of image and text?
Yes, combination of image and text.
Well, I think that's as a result of my own personal background. I graduated with a degree in English literature, and I think I always wanted to be a writer. At the same time, I began photographing and was drawn to the work of people like Lewis Hine and Jacob Riis and so on. And as a result, my work combines image and text. A more recent influence, for sure, was when I first came to Indiana, I had an opportunity to work with the great nonfiction writer Scott Sanders, who's retired now but taught in the English department in creative writing for years here and influenced a generation of writers. And we did a project that became published as Stone Country, which was a combination of photographs I had taken of the landscape around here, the workers in the mills and quarries and the buildings around the country that are made from Indiana limestone. And Scott, we would go side by side, and he would, as I was setting up my big view camera, he would be interviewing people and drawing out little historical facts and anecdotes. So when that book came out, seeing my photographs with Scott's words was very exciting, but it pushed me one step further, which was to become my own writer with my photographs. And I'd had experience with that as well. I studied in graduate school. I used to make books, little art books, small edition art books with my writings and photographs. But to do it professionally, I think the work with Scott really pushed me to that point.
Now, that book, I checked it out of the library, and it's Scott primarily has the text initially. It's a fairly good size book, and then the photographs follow.
Right.
The photographs do seem still to have a quality that you retain. To me, in capturing some of those people in the photographs as well, and how the people are in the photographs as elements of that scene, as pictures are still life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
there is a sense that these people are part of that still life.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great observation. I'm glad you picked that up. That book, the portraits for that book, really changed the direction of my work, because I was really doing large format landscapes. And that's what really started me in the quarries. You know, Breaking Away had come out, and I was drawn to the quarries and the mills and the light and all of that, and just the massive undertaking of a quarry, of extractive industries. But what came out on the other end 3 or 4 years later was portraiture. Mm. and which I really didn't have a lot of experience with up until that point. And so, and what you're talking about is what I try to do, which is an environmental portrait or milieu photography, where the person and the background interact. The person becomes part of the background informs the person, you know, the viewer about the person. And so I try to layer the photographs, even to this day, with that kind of approach.
That struck me as pretty clearly what's going on in the Vietnam book as well, that the individuals are captured as part of a scene that you have, in a sense, written yourself. The picture seems written by Jeff Wolin. In the Vietnam book, there's text, too, that are memoirs or little anecdotes. Not little. They're sometimes very long, sometimes shorter, but almost always powerful. And the picture set next to that powerful memory of a time gone by, and in a sense, you call it inconvenient stories. We tend to want to reduce that time in our history as in the United States, and the stories they tell, the pictures you have, create that sense that this happened and it led to these people in this place doing these things, and they came back, and this is that comeback picture, in a sense, right? This is who they are after that. And on the side with the memoir is a little picture, usually, I believe, the people in Vietnam. So there's a soldier picture, and then what kind of where they are now picture.
Right.
The where they are now pictures, the ones you frame, are located, but yet nowhere frequently, in the sense that I wouldn't really be able to identify any geographical location. They're often in their living rooms. Sometimes they're in a parking lot. Sometimes they're on a golf course.
How do you photograph the past
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
today? How does somebody, if you're a writer, you can write a memoir. You can interview somebody and they can talk about their past. But if you take a photograph of them now in the present, how do you convey the past? So that's really the challenge for visual artists, but specifically for photographers. You can see that the thread in the work from the Holocaust survivors to the Vietnam veterans to now to people who've lived through who've had a childhood or a life in public housing projects. How does one overcome adversity?
Mm-hmm.
And how can you become stronger by confronting something? Something horrible, something traumatic, and World War II, the Holocaust, the Vietnam War, or a childhood in a particularly difficult childhood, environment. How does somebody overcome those things? And if you find people that have overcome that, not been either killed by the experience directly or mentally damaged. They have something, I think, really important to teach the rest of us.
Well, when you spoke there about photographing the past, in a sense, capturing in the present moment the culmination of the past, that all this has happened to this person. And as you try to frame it, you include specifics in their environment, books or golf clubs or a particular hat or shoes that seem indicative of the situation, or someone in sock feet.
Yeah.
There are telling little pieces there that say this is the present, but this present exists because of this past.
Right.
Is it? Yes.
And some of the devices I use are snapshots.
Mm-hmm.
That somebody might hold a photograph. From their past, a loved one who died, but who mattered to them. They might hold, as you say, an object that's symbolic. There's a guy who survived Auschwitz because he had been trained as an electrician, and he's that's what he did after the war. He was made a living as an electrician, and he had his tools.
Pictures on your website, I think.
I have pictures of his name is Hans Fink. He was from Berlin. I have pictures of him with his tool belt. And it's it just, you know, there. I try to make these details.
Let me break in real quick with that, because in looking at those pictures online, too, it's a fairly large amount of text there within the body of the photograph.
Right.
And so the text is the framing element as much as anything there. It's in the background, but it's really in the foreground, too. It's a big part of the picture.
Right.
And on the web, I couldn't really read them. And I don't know if you when in exhibitions or installations you can read them very well or not.
You can read them. I was evolving my techniques through this, and they're definitely legible, but they were challenging.
Do you write them?
Yes.
Okay,
it was
so
my
handwriting. Okay.
It was my handwriting, and as opposed to asking each individual to write, that they were additions. They were six of each or eight of each. It wouldn't have worked out for me to ask people to do that. It might have been very interesting to see all the different handwritings, styles of handwriting, and I have lousy handwriting, but what people respond to is the fact that it is handwritten as opposed to typographic. And I moved for a while with Vietnam veterans to a typographic form for the narrative. And now I'm back to handwriting. There's something warmer and more personal, even if it's, you know, bad, my own bad handwriting. It works. I use this beautiful silver ink, and that's written directly onto the photographs, and people like that. It's a way of altering the purity of the photographic modernist, approach to photography. So I had a solo show of the Holocaust portraits in Chicago at the Art Institute of Chicago, and there were three photography galleries that they're still there in the basement of the Art Institute of the museum, and I had the opportunity of going to see the show a few times. You know, it wasn't so far away, and each time I went there to just look at the show and see how it, you know, take some installation shots and so on. I would think there's nobody in there, 'cause it's so quiet. But I'd come around the bend and into the gallery, and it would be packed, and people two and three deep. And they were reading, you know. I didn't expect that. I thought, oh, maybe, you know, if I'm lucky, they'll just grab a few words here and there, and we have a book, and they can read the book. But at the art, you know, museums and the galleries, people, you know, surprised me by taking my challenge and reading the stories, and people were sobbing, or, you know, just it was so quiet because it was like a memorial.
Well, I tell you, this again, I'll go back to the veterans book, because it's the one I spent most time with, but there is in it that definite aspect for me that many of the stories did take me to that place too, where they were just overwhelming stories, and next to the people that are there still living, and yet having all of that living in them, and the text and the face, the environment, really drew me into that emotional space. And it's interesting to think of it in terms of the word, and why I started with this again. I went once to the Vietnam War Memorial. I don't think I could go back, because I know nothing. I don't have anybody in, you know, that went to Vietnam. The memorial just knocked me out, and I don't know what it was. Right, the words. I mean, names, name, but names are, you know, they're words, and I sat there and read them. No one to read for, in a sense, but it was just that sense of, you know, this is a naming space of loss. And it was just a powerful experience for me. And a lot of this, I spent a couple of days just really not being able to get past one or two of these. So they had the same kind of pull for me.
You know, I did a sequel where I went. One of the veterans at one of the museum openings suggested that I, John Lindemeyer from Bloomington, that I do something with the other side. And that led to two trips to Vietnam with John along with me, interviewing and photographing Vietnamese veterans, and that was really a fabulous experience, because you would sometimes have an American soldier in the book here, and a Vietnamese soldier, NVA, and, you know, North Vietnamese Army regular, and they would be in the same place at the same time fighting in the same battle, and shooting at each other, based more or less, you know, more or less. And it just was really interesting to get such a very different perspective on war. It was like that movie Rashomon from Kurosawa, where you have different people witnessing the same murder, you know, but they go to court and each person tells a different version because our perceptions, our memories are our constructions, you know, and each person sees things and remembers things differently. You know, they all agreed on the central facts, but they disagreed completely on how the murder occurred. And so it was so interesting to find these different perspectives. But what they had in common that was fascinating, these different armies that were shooting each other and killing each other, was a respect for each other and the same nightmares, the same kinds of nightmares, the same stories of being separated from your unit, mm-hmm. and hearing the enemy approaching, and you hide, and then somebody stops right by your bush or your wall or whatever it is, and picks up whatever you're covering yourself with, and you wake up screaming, and that was such a common sort of nightmare for war veterans in Vietnam, and just post-traumatic stress, which we don't really like to talk about that very much, but if you send young people to war, they're going to come back with post-traumatic stress if they're combat vets.
When it will show up sometimes too.
That's right.
People appear very normal, or, for lack of a better term, and it's in there. And often, like you say, a loud noise. Sometimes things can be set stress sets those things off. And it's I don't know how we could conceive of it otherwise. How you can come back normal in a sense. You know, how you can come back and fit into your life. And that's again, I think part of why this is powerful is that sense that these are pictures of people in normal life.
Right.
They're again, because they're framed and staged in a particular way, they're not necessarily that normal. They are a thing to read, which I think is part of the position. You know, things are positioned or they're sitting or you want them holding certain things, and in a way, after you read the text, you read the photograph, or you read the photograph first, and you read the text, or you go back and forth because in the text made you think of something in the photograph. And I think you and I, and we had a previous meeting earlier, we talked a little bit about the genesis of the creating the portrait. If you read or talked to the veterans prior to creating the idea of the photograph, the framing of it, what you would use in it. So you would go there with knowing the story that they might have told. It was already a written document before you took pictures, or?
No, what I would do is, and this was just a strategy that I developed initially for this kind of work, is I would do a videotape interview with each person, and then I would do the photography. At the end of the video sessions, the interview gave me some knowledge of their story, and that enabled me to find the visual elements that I wanted to combine in the portrait.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Jeff Wolin, a photographer and professor of photography at Indiana University. We're talking about his work. Jeff, we just talked about your work with Vietnam war veterans, your book Inconvenient Stories, and the thing that strikes me as interesting, or even that evolution we talked about as you've grown putting text and pictures or images and portraits together into your next project as well, the Pigeon Hill Project. Describe the Pigeon Hill Project for us, and then we can talk a little bit about it.
Sure. So what happened was I began writing on pictures that were of a very personal nature. They were autobiographical. And after a few years of that, and that's what sort of built my career.
You began personally?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
So in the 1980s, after working with Scott and his brilliant writing, I wanted to do my own writing. And I began by taking images that were symbolic and reflected some experiences of mine from my childhood and young adulthood. Why and how did I become the person that I became? What were the formative experiences? And so I found photographic images that corresponded to that and started writing on them. And that was what I got known for in my world, in photography. After a few years, I sort of ran out of things to say about myself, and I was here, and so I needed something to do, and so this was the this was 1987. A graduate student from Indiana University had been murdered up on Pigeon Hill, Ellen Marks, and there was a lot in the newspaper about the housing projects and how dangerous they were. There was nationwide the crack cocaine epidemic. Had exploded, and there was a lot about under Reagan ending welfare and ending any kind of social services for the poor. So and again, there was a lot about crime and all of this in the projects across the country. Well, this is where I live, so I wanted to explore my world, and I started going. The Crestmont housing projects, which are part of Pigeon Hill, is the bluffs west of, on the west side of town, just overlooking maybe a mile or two from campus, where used to be just shacks, and where poor people lived. Every city, every town has such a section. And so every photographer who'd gone to Indiana University to school had done a documentary project. Jerry Uelsman, who's known for a completely different kind of, surrealist work, did a documentary project up there. Jack Welpot, everybody. And so for all of those reasons, and in a way to explore my father's deep-rooted poverty, that he grew up in a just horrific poverty and never able to transcend that. So I had a kind of a personal connection to it. I didn't grow up in a situation like that, but he did, and we knew about it from him. And here I was. So it was the 1980s. Ellen Marks had been murdered. There was a lot in the paper about Pigeon Hill. I'd never set foot up there. One day I had my car was being repaired over there, a place called Autosport, and I took a cab ride back, and it stopped in front of one of the housing projects, and a young man walks out, and then he helps his father, who's in a walker, very frail, walks out, and they walk to the cab, and the guy is holding his father's hips as the father is walking down the steps, and they put the father in the front seat. And all the while, there's a little boy in coming out of the house too, and he's doing pirouettes. He's just a kid, and he's having fun, and he's spinning around. And it's just this little vignette, this little scene, and it's stuck in my mind. And I wrote a little essay about it, wrote a little short story about this. And I'm sitting in the cab, and we're going just a few blocks away for the father to get a haircut. There was a barber shop right under the tracks there on 11th Street, and we just went a few blocks in the cab. I was heading to work, to campus. And I talked to the guy, the son, about his father, and he was telling about his father's cancer, and he smoked and drank and, had a hard life. And I said, well, he must be pretty old. He's, no, he's like 45. He looked much older than I thought he was. And that was it. So that was sort of the last link. And then I started going to photograph. I just would go out there with my camera. I have a big camera. And I would go there and photograph, and then I would go back the following week. I'd develop and print. This is the era of film. I would develop and print my pictures, and I'd go back the next week, find the people I photographed, give them the prints, take more photographs and more photographs. And for 4 years, I built connections with that community and was known as Picture Man. So I photographed literally hundreds and hundreds of people, several extended families, but much of the community between 87 and 91. In 91, I got a Guggenheim Fellowship with the idea that I would complete the project, that I would bring it to completion. But that didn't happen. Instead, what I did during that year was the seeds of the Holocaust Project and the Vietnam Project. So for 20 years, that's what I did. It took a long time to bring those two projects to completion. But about 2.5 years ago, again, on the front page of a paper was another murder. This time it was a woman named Crystal Grubb, who was 29. And the police have not arrested anyone for the murder, although it's been 2.5 years. It was related to meth. Her boyfriend was cooking meth. Mm. And she was hanging out with the wrong people and wound up murdered. They had a picture of this woman who'd been you know, this woman who was missing first, and then they found her body. And I immediately recognized her as one of the kids that I had photographed 20 years earlier. And sure enough, it was. And I found her mom and her cousins and aunts, who were people that I knew very well from a generation earlier. And that kind of made me want to revisit the photograph. I always liked those portraits that I had done, but I never did anything with them. I didn't really the idea of completion wasn't, it never got to that point. It was just sort of on the back burner for 25 years.
Well, you can see then the idea that, you know, you're drawn into this idea of following up what was the present that you experienced and took photographs of, and then accidentally, you know, you discover something that sort of pulls you back, that has meaning to you. So you get the sense that it's not a project to be a project. It's a project that means something to you, that there is a direct connection to the place, the people you got to know. There is a sense, I think, in the pictures too, for me, and the sense of beyond sort of cultural commentary, which is deeply involved in the Vietnam book, I think, as well in the presentation. But here in the Pigeon Hill pictures, they're really a commentary on poverty and how lives are lived, how lives are lost, how they are disappeared, how they are not seen, how that is an entire world that none of us on this side see.
Right. And they're invisible.
Your photographs give them reality, give them a story, give them a life that has meaning, not just to them, but to all of us. And so I was talking to some friends, and I thought there is, to me, a sense of activism.
Well, there are certain issues that come up in the project sort of organically, but one is the criminalization of the underclass in this country. We have more people in prison as a percentage of the population than any country, I think, on Earth, including China and the Soviet Union, Russia, or the Middle East, Middle Eastern countries, which we think of as very oppressive. And we've privatized the prisons. And we've victimized the victims, and there's a quite a few of the people that I know, especially the males, started making babies with their girlfriends at very young ages, without any real opportunity or means of providing for those children, and now they're in prison because they can't pay child support, so they fall further and further behind. Go back to prison because they can't pay child support, and it's just an unending cycle of criminalization. Once they get out, they're convicted felons. They can't hold. You know, it's very difficult for them to get good jobs. So how does somebody break through that very, very difficult pull of our culture? Why do we criminalize the underclass and make it so difficult for them to enter the middle class or shockingly, you know, the upper class? What opportunities do people have to? We think of ourselves as the American dream. You know, we're a mobile society. People can, if you're smart, if you work hard, you can escape anything. Right. And that's what brings immigrants to America. But what about our own people? What opportunities do they have to get out? And sometimes you see people self-victimize. They wind up, because of their upbringing, because of the conditions of poverty, making decisions that certainly are going to ensure that they're going to struggle.
Right. Well, in that sense, you've got the effects of the poverty and the prison system as well, that the children at the time, you know, your dad's in prison, or your dad's not anywhere around because of that. You've got a mother who works multiple jobs, a grandmother who works multiple jobs, and daycare or no care, or aunts that, you know, all this sense that there is no stability in that place at all. Economic stability primarily. Where do your next meals come from? Are you going to get to stay in your house?
Yeah, there's a lot of mobility. A lot of people are evicted, mm-hmm. which was something my father experienced. Yeah, they never knew where they were going to to, you know, when they were going to get kicked out of. They couldn't pay the rent, and they would move. And that happens to this day in the public housing sector, particularly in Section 8. They're kicking people out of one of the places on the south side, Acadia Court. It's a real problem, and I'm just fascinated by those who have been able to escape those conditions. One other thing that I want to say that's very positive about there that I noticed right away and it drew me there once I began photographing was it's kind of in some ways it's a very nice life for the children because of these extended families. Mm-hmm. So you would if your parents pissed you off, you'd have dinner with your cousin down the block. And you, after school, you opened your door and there'd be 20 friends, you know, and it was a very different kind of environment than my children, who were the same age, you know, growing up in Bloomington in suburbia in Spicewood, you know, where as parents, you have to drive your kids everywhere for them to have entertainment, for them to have friendships, for them to, you know. Right. Play.
Your friendships are as organized as everything else we do.
Yeah.
You go here to have a friend, not just out your front door.
They would play their little pickup baseball and dodgeball and football games and, you know, and ride their bikes everywhere. And if their bikes broke, they'd learn how to fix them. And they helped each other. And the extended families, an issue that Kurt Vonnegut, the great Hoosier writer, mm-hmm. talks at length about, the whole idea of tribes and extended families is very active there. And that's really something that I admired and missed in my own children's development.
You've been listening to The Custom House on WFHB. I'm Doug Storm. We've been joined by Jeff Wolin. He's the Ruth N. Halls Professor of Photography at Indiana University. Thanks for spending time with us, Jeff.
It's been a pleasure, Doug. Thanks.
All right. Thank you for listening as well.
You've been listening to The Custom House, a weekly discussion of literature beyond the binding. Each episode is available on our website, wfhb.org, along with extended cuts and further discussion. Our theme music is provided by EDM. The Custom House is produced by Doug Storm. Executive producer is Allison Bechtesh.